Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
It was a building that brought joy to so many. It hosted classic games on the diamond and on the gridiron. The World Series was played there three times. An NFL playoff game was contested there. College football was played there. And of course, concerts featuring the Rolling Stones, Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, and so many others. The movie Major League was shot there. And it is also the site where Hulk Hogan beat Andre the Giant in a steel cage match. And next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to reminisce a little about a stadium long gone, but one that harbors great memories for so many. Milwaukee County Stadium.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 110, Milwaukee County Stadium. Yes, something slightly different than my normal topics. Can a stadium be a forgotten hero? Good question. But I will tell you this. There are so many ballparks, stadiums, arenas that have long since been demolished. But when you talk about them, they conjure up memories of days long gone. Memories that put smiles on so many faces. And days that people can recall as if those days were yesterday. They remember the great heroes like a Hank Aaron or Bart Starr at Milwaukee County Stadium. And stars whom time has forgotten. Guys like Bill Bruton, who hit a game-winning home run in the 10th inning in the Milwaukee Braves' first-ever game in Milwaukee to give them a 3-2 win over the St. Louis Cardinals. And while the Braves and Brewers are probably most closely associated with County Stadium, we can't forget that the Green Bay Packers also called the stadium home for a number of years, 1953 through 1994. Yes, the Packers played anywhere from 2 to 4 games a year there before leaving Milwaukee permanently to call Lambeau Field home on a permanent basis. And who could blame them, as Lambeau Field is one of the best in the National Football League. Joining me on today's episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes is Jim Crines. He just recently finished a book called On Story Parkway. This is not a small book. In fact, it's over 600 pages. Jim talks about the history of the stadium over the first few chapters, from its birth through its last stand. And then he's compiled dozens upon dozens of stories from those who played there and those who had great memories to share. The book, not intended to be read in one sitting, not by a long shot, is really something else, a very unique concept. And if you are interested in getting a copy, listen closely. You must email Jim at jimcrines@gmail.com, and he'll connect with you so you can order it. Again, that's jimcrines@gmail.com. jimcrines@gmail.com to get your copy of On Story Parkway. All right, before we get to my conversation with Jim, as always, a few notes for you. Sports Forgotten Heroes is a proud member of the Sports History Network. Check it out at sportshistorynetwork.com. This is where you can go to find several podcasts about sports history. There's a lot of great content there for your listening pleasure. Also, don't forget to follow this podcast, Sports Forgotten Heroes, on Twitter at SportsFHeroes. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Instagram. Look for the Sports Forgotten Heroes page on Facebook as well. I make daily and weekly posts on all of these platforms. More information and stats on the stars of yesteryear, the stars I talk about. And it's where you can see some pretty cool pictures of everyone as well. And of course, check out sportsfh.com for more information on the forgotten heroes I talk about, more information about my guests, and if you have a question, comment, or an idea for a forgotten hero you would like to know more about, just fill out the contact form and I'll certainly reach back out to you. Again, that's sportsfh.com. As always, please give Sports Forgotten Heroes a 5-star rating if you are listening on Apple Podcasts. And as always, thank you for listening. Now, let's get into today's show about Milwaukee County Stadium with my guest, Jim Crine. And now joining me is Jim Crines, author of the book on Story Parkway, Remembering County Stadium. Jim, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Thanks so much, Warren. I appreciate it. Good to be here.
Hey, so tell us about the book on Story Parkway, Remembering County Stadium. Why did you decide to write it? And where can fans of Sports Forgotten Heroes and Milwaukee Sports get a copy of it?
Well, in keeping with your first part of the question, I've always been intrigued. Baseball has always been my game. And, you know, while I enjoy some of the others, it's always been baseball, hands down. Growing up in Chicago and my first time seeing Wrigley Field and then moving up to the Milwaukee area and the first time seeing County Stadium, a lot of men can remember that first moment of seeing that green, just everlasting, beautiful greenery. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone listening to this can relate to that. So I covered the Brewers for 24 years in media, and I also wrote for their magazines. So I spent a lot of time at County Stadium. And it dawned on me that nobody had really captured the history of what went on there. And I, as much as I like some of the new aspects of baseball, the Miller Parks and now Amphim Field and, you know, the new Comiskeys, my heart is in Wrigley. My heart is in the old County Stadium. It's at Fenway. And I don't know that I can describe why. I mean, it just is. And I think I needed to pay some homage to that structure. As much as it was dilapidated, as much as it was antiquated, and essentially, you know, it was a nice ballpark, obviously, when it was built. But I think a lot of that came back to me, and I figured I wanted to be part of that again in a corny way. I wanted to be part of all that memory, part of all that history. And for me, I've always been intrigued with the nuances and the periphery of the things that go on in a ballpark. I'm intrigued by players, why they do what they do and how they do what they do, rather than ERA, batting average, and things like that. So it's always been intriguing to me to find the inner workings of a ballpark, the inner workings of baseball players. So as to point out for this project, I've written numerous books, but I don't consider myself per se as much as an author on this one, as much as a conduit from all the folks that participated in this book. It's 677 pages,
yeah,
and it's quite a thing. And then But it's the fans. It's the memories from the fans. It's the memories from media. It's the memories from former players that are the foundation of this thing, and they're the structure of this project. And Bud Selig did write the foreword, and I had some great chapters early on about some of the history of Milwaukee mm-hmm. Brewers. I had some talk of how the split from Boston to Milwaukee. I just wanted to cover some cursory stuff that a lot of serious baseball fans already knew, but that all segued to what is still the seminal baseball team in Milwaukee, which was the 1982 team. And I have mixed emotions about that, you know, success and or lack of total success. As I said earlier, I'm intrigued by the nuances, and this intrigued me as to why a city would still embrace so wholeheartedly something for coming in second. Yeah. And that interests me. So in answer to your question in a roundabout way, I'm intrigued with the what's and the hows more than I am just the stats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And where can people get a copy of the book?
Well, right now it's in transition. They literally have to email me right now. It was number one baseball book on Amazon for a few weeks. And I sold a lot of books, more than I thought I would. Mm. And so now it's through me until I'm segueing. Costco's looking at it. A couple other venues, Barnes and Noble, but they would have to get in touch with me right now if they want to, and I can give the email
sure.
later if you like.
Sure.
But it's something that you know, I've never anticipated the excitement as much. You know, I had media outlets. My background's in media,
mm-hmm.
so I had nothing but people reaching out to me for this. I had morning shows. I had sports shows all asking if I could come on for this. And that's not something that, as a self-published book, that's not something that you're used to. I mean, you're used to selling a few copies of something, but this one really transcended. I had a deal for this book, and things changed and morphed, so I ended up doing it on my own. But there was a publisher with the intent of going with this project. And it didn't end up there. And for me, in a lot of ways, it's more gratifying because I got to steer this thing the way I wanted it to be. But again, you know, I keep coming back to the people that made this book possible, and that's the fans. I had 250 memories submitted. I had to cull that down. I had 150 original photographs, you know, probably 250 submitted. Just never before seen items and, you know, just the outpouring from people has been just extraordinary. It's like I can flip through that book now and see a name and remember their story. It's really amazing, and I can't remember what I had for dinner, but I can remember the names of these people, what they did. You know, I see a photo and I know who sent it. So it's been an extremely intimate thing and a very large thing. So I don't know, it's difficult to describe, mm-hmm. but to have such an intimate knowledge of these people and their memory, and the last time they went to the park with their father, the time they, you know, when Ray Crone of the Braves took his parents out there, and he has a photograph of his wife and his parents, and, you know, Anita Dalbec was on the field in a big debutante's dress, giving a Cadillac to Andy Pafko, and, you know, you just see, I had a lot of friends in the Brewers locker room and the team, and seeing these guys with their hair down, so to speak, and seeing these guys, you know, who they really are. And that all gets back to me feeling comfortable in my skin with these guys.
Right. Well, Jim, like you said, the book is almost 700 pages, and about the first 150 really takes you through the history of how the stadium came about, the Milwaukee Braves being there, the Milwaukee Brewers. And then it's all personal memories. So let's go with personal memories first. And for you, Jim Crines, what is your personal fondest memory of County Stadium?
Fondest. I have a memory that I'll get to secondly that is my most vivid memory. But in terms of fondest, I don't know. I took in so many things, like Henderson's season record on stolen bases. I was there for Molitor's streak, most of it, and the end of it. funny. I can't come out with one, but let me tell you the one that I remember most distinctly. There's a loge in front of Bob Uecker. If you know the stadium, you know what I'm talking about. It's an area there where broadcast media would sit. The print media had a tendency to be a little arrogant, and they had their whole area, and they looked down upon us in a figurative and literal sense, looking down on us in this mezzanine corrugated tin area. And we had like a family down there, Warren. It was really strange among our broadcasters and radio and television. It was like a private club. So we sat right below Bob Uecker, who befriended all of us, and I think he actually befriended us more than the print guys. So Len Casper was a good friend of mine who's now with the Sox, but he was with the Cubs for their play-by-play on television for a long time, and the Marlins before that. So he and I go way back. I used to write songs for his band, and so we grew up together. So I had injured my left ear during a flight into D.C. many years ago. It descended too quickly, and I had a cold and probably shouldn't have been flying in the first place. So rule number one in any ballpark is don't take your eyes off the field when they're in play. So I was talking to Len about something, you know, so I'm turned to my right. And then I don't even know if I remember hearing the crack of the bat, but if you know anything about being behind a foul ball, a batter's foul ball, it comes up there like lightning.
Sure.
And all I remember him saying is, "Jimmy," he yelled out, and he reached out his hand, he blocked my temple where this 150-mile-an-hour ball was going. And it slapped in his hand. It sounded like an infant being born, and it was just swelled up his hand. But I'm honestly, I say in the book that he saved my life, and he did, you know, because it was just an amazing kind of thing to have happen to me. And even with that, I still love County Stadium. But, yeah, I mean, don't take your eyes off the field. You know what I mean? It was literally the dumbest thing I'd ever done. If it hadn't been for Lancaster, I'd probably would have died.
It's funny.
What a place to die, though, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, at a ballpark?
Yep. It's funny.
If you got to go, I mean, I could think of worse places.
Yeah. Years ago, when my son was just about a year old, I was visiting family in Philadelphia, and we went to the old Vet, and they got us great seats. We were sitting behind home plate, and I was never more nervous in my life. And I had these great seats, and I had to leave. I couldn't take it. Foul balls are whizzing by. I got this one-year-old infant in my hands. Maybe he was two. He was right around that age. And I picked him up, and we went out, and we sat in the center field seats, and I finally felt comfortable.
Yeah, you didn't have no screens?
Yeah, way back when. Yep.
No, they didn't. I mean, that's like a death sentence. No, yeah. I mean, even Wrigley, growing up, I think they just had the, you know, the one right behind home plate. But, you know, we've seen, I can understand that you did the right thing.
Yeah, I was
no
right
way,
off
even
the,
like, little girls at the game.
Yeah, I was right,
I mean,
off
I'm
the
on,
side
on the
of
edge
the net.
Of my seat. If you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, my first Chicago Blackhawks game, someone got nailed with a puck near me. And I'm like, you know what? It behooves you to keep your eye on the ball or the puck in that instance. But you did the right thing, you know?
Yeah.
You can't sit back there without protection.
No, it was crazy. So let me ask you another question. So many people contributed to your book with their favorite stories, their big remembrance of County Stadium. Is there one that you heard that you said, wow, that's really cool, that you can share with us?
There's an amalgamation of a bunch of them that kind of come together. I think I mentioned a couple, but there was a situation, again, getting back to the nuances, I don't think anything was explosive, but I do think that a guy named John Adam, who was the head trainer of the Brewers, and you'll see his memory in there, I attribute a lot of the success of the stories to him. He's a real funny guy. You put a quarter in him and he'll talk for an hour. And he's given me so much access to the inner workings. One of my favorite stories is if you're not a Brewer fan, you might not remember Team Streak, where I think they won 13 in a row. And there was a big Easter Day game. And they're coming off the road. They were pretty uptight because, you know, it's a lot to hold on your shoulders to maintain something like that. And John took it upon himself to have an Easter egg hunt. And So what he did was, it's Easter Sunday, and they're all grumbling, like, oh, God, John, we don't want to do this. And but he said when the first guy found his egg, they all got pretty pretty jazzed up, as baseball players do, that competitive that competitive spirit, right? So they all, he hit a bunch of, we put their number on them. They're like, I got mine. And the other guys are like, damn it, where's mine? And they're all looking around. So he had four eggs that were special to him. So while everybody was came off the field from BP and infield practice or whatever, he went out there and he put Robin Yount's egg in center field. Then he went and put Paul Molitor's on the side of the base because he said it rolled off. And he said he couldn't do anything with B.J. Surhoff, who was behind the plate. So what he did was the umpire was coming down the walkway right before the game. This was probably a sellout. And he explained what he was doing. The umpire looked, he kind of looked into his bag and let him put the egg in there, into his ball bag.
That's cool.
So they all get on their positions, and they're, you know, they're catching, playing catch or whatever. And Robin finds his first, and he picks it up looking at it quizzically, and he looks to the dugout, and the whole dugout is cracking up. So he whips it on the ground with everything he has. And the ball, the egg explodes. Then we go over to Paul Molitor, who's taking grounders, and he picks up his egg, finds it, he tosses it at the dugout, but again, it kind of busts up and rolls away before it reaches there. And then this is the funniest part of it, when B.J. Surhoff, you know, was sitting behind the plate, and the first pitch comes in, it's fouled back, and you know how catchers just reach their hand back for the next ball?
Yeah.
The umpire put an egg in his hand. And he looked at it, you know, like, what the heck is this? And threw it. So there's so many stories like that that mean something to me. And, you know, and I think that, you know, Ray Crone telling me about his family coming to the games. And, you know, we had so many. One kid was a ball boy for. I should point out, Warren, that, as you know, a lot of this book is about other things that happen at County Stadium, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just baseball, even though the predominant amount of it is. But we had concerts. We had Pink Floyd, the Rolling Stones. We had the Green Bay Packers played there from 53 to 93, four games a year. So, I mean, it was really their home field for four games a year until they left in 94. And they rebuilt Lambeau after that. But a guy by the name of Bob Harlan, who was president and CEO of the Packers for many years, credits Milwaukee for the Packers still being around today. So he and I developed kind of a quasi-friendship. Tom Treblehorn and I have been friends since I started the book. You know, he's been so helpful, but now we're email buddies. And so many people, Dave Baldwin of the Pilots, I got to know, and he was the first team to come over. A lot of people listening know the history of the Pilots, spending just one season in the majors. And Bud Selig was looking for a team, and he purchased the Pilots at the last moment, a week before the season started. And all the gear was on its way to Seattle, and they switched to Milwaukee. They just turned on the road and went to Milwaukee, and they replaced the S with an M and kept, basically kept the colors.
Yep.
And, I mean, that's a neat story in its own right, you know, that in 1 week before the season they get a ball club.
And I did a podcast on the Pilots and all of that.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much and so little there, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, what a tragedy for the, you know,
Seattle
to be a team and then it goes away so quickly. Yeah. There's a lot of people that don't get over that. A lot of people don't forgive the Braves for leaving Milwaukee.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about all of that. So, Bud Selig, the old commissioner of baseball, former owner of the Brewers. Like you said, he wrote the intro to the book. You cover a lot about Bud. I particularly like the story he told about he and his friend Herb Cole finally realizing that Major League Baseball was coming to town when the Boston Braves moved to Milwaukee. So I got a couple questions in here. And let's start it with this. What is it about baseball that Milwaukeeans, are you Milwaukeeans, is a different term. What is it about baseball that Milwaukeeans love so much?
Well, it's kind of strange. I don't know if it's baseball as much as They love devotion. They love loyalty. They love, you know, they love that sense of being part of something. I'm not saying they don't love baseball, but they're the same way with their football teams, the same way. I moved up here from Chicago, so it takes a while for people to get used to you when you move to Wisconsin. They just aren't as effusive as other places. And this is back in the 70s. And it took a while, but these people, and I've heard this from many, many people, they live and die with their sports. But with Milwaukee, and I'll use the 82 team as an example, that they knew those guys were giving 100%. You know, they weren't the prettiest. They weren't all the most talented. They were kind of, they had some great players. But fans knew, that these guys were going to run through a wall for you, hence the name Harvey's Wallbangers. But I really think, Warren, that that's part of it. And sure, they love their baseball, but it's something about these folks that really reward loyalty. You know, they really reward people going all out for them. And it's true in the Packers. It's true. I mean, think of how many sellouts there were with the Packers. Mm-hmm. They were lousy forever. And with baseball, you know, we draw $3 million a year. When was the last time we were in serious contention? And I think that, again, it gets back to, if you're good to me, I'll be good to you. Mm-hmm. And as long as they smell that you're giving 100%, and believe me, they can smell when you're not. That's one thing about Milwaukee fans, they do know. But the interesting thing about Milwaukee to me is Robin Yount could have played anywhere after his first few years. You know, he was just a stellar ball player. Mm-hmm. But with John Adam, told me, he's friends with Robin. He calls him Kid. I don't call him Kid because I don't know him, but he can call him Kid. And he said, Robin attributes Milwaukee with part of his success because had he been in a different market, he would have been torn apart by critics. You know, New York would have ripped him up, L.A., and I think that he liked Milwaukee for the very reasons I've cited here. So, you know, why does any city love baseball? I don't know. But, I mean, if we're going to take a team, I think that, you know, being in media, we didn't rip our players as much as New York and L.A. would. We were more, I don't want to say homers, but we were more understanding and less, we wouldn't do a story on, you know, something that was salacious. I think we respected them enough as ball players, but I think in a lot of other cities and towns, you know, they do that. They attack players and go for the headlines. So it all gets back to people in Milwaukee being very simple for the most part in a great way. I mean, this city has grown like you wouldn't believe in the last 20 years, but we're down to earth people. Midwestern people are pretty down to earth. And we say what we mean, and we mean what we say. And we just aren't into all the pageantry and all the BS that goes around so many places. So a long-winded answer to your question, if it is baseball, I think they're more in tune to people than they are anything else. And I think that, again, if you're good to them, they'll be good to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, the people of Milwaukee wanted a baseball team for the longest period of time, a team that they could call their own, and finally they got one when the Braves came to Milwaukee. Then the Braves left for Atlanta, and then the Pilots, as you noted, moved to Milwaukee. So tell us a little bit about what it was like the first time Milwaukee got a team, and then finally when Milwaukee got a team the second time around. Very unusual for a city to get two shots at it.
No, I agree with you. And I think that, as I mentioned a minute ago, they got the team. Lou Perini wanted to a fresh start. They'd won in Boston just 5 years before. They had won and the pennant. And so there was that whole thing, you know, the county stadium was built on county funds, hence the name, but not a lot of ballparks were done that way. And the park was completed and ready to go in 1953, but we didn't have a tenant. We didn't have an MLB tenant. We had the AAA Brewers who were ready to come in, and they never got the chance because the Braves moved in. But I think that what I touched on a few minutes ago about the loyalty, this town went berserk for the Braves. I mean, they gave everything they had. They supported them. They gave them, they showered them with all the incentives and breaks. And these guys coming from Boston, I don't think they really got it, you know, and you may know Boston better than I do. I just don't think they felt the effusive praise, admiration, and love from the Brewers fans. So they had parades when these guys just came to town. And then the first 3 or 4 years, it was nothing but a love affair. And then there's some culpability on both sides, I think, that things started to diminish. I think, you know, Perini, in my research, kind of, he had his eye out the door to the better deal. You know, mm-hmm. Atlanta later was going to give him the money. And this, you'd be hard-pressed to tell me that he wasn't into the bigger deals. And so they kind of backed off on the quality on the field. They traded some stars, started to tighten their belt a bit, and then the fans retaliated by not coming to the park. And so, you know, you can point fingers back and forth, the chicken or the egg on that one, but attendance fell dramatically. And so they gave them reason to start looking elsewhere. Atlanta provided them with money that Milwaukee never could mm-hmm. in terms of television deals and marketing and things like that. So when they did leave, there was, you know, Bud Selig relates, I really believe these people were heartbroken. I mean, I'm going to be 60, so I wasn't, you know, here then, or didn't know the Braves. But mm-hmm. I do know that a lot of people never forgave the team for leaving. And they, to this day, they've never attended another ball game, which is kind of crazy. I mean, things change.
Yeah.
But so in answer to that, yeah, Milwaukee, I don't know that you could have ever found a town more grateful and more loving and accepting of a team. So then the honeymoon wore off for both sides kind of rubbed each other. They left. So Bud Selig tried. He's a pretty determined guy. And, you know, he may not be the swankiest. He may not be the flashiest. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a guy that was more steadfast and wouldn't take no for an answer. So since the Braves left until 1970, he tried, as you know, brought White Sox games to County Stadium, mm-hmm. regular season White Sox games, because they were terrible at Comiskey. And Art Allen owned the Sox then, and he was just tickled. There was a point where he wanted to sell the Sox to Bud Selig, but his brother interceded and killed that deal. And so he kept on reaching out. You know, there were other options for him to get a team, and things fell through. And it really started to look pretty bleak until he got the Pilots. And I think that, you know, they were lousy for a long time, but I don't think that diminished Milwaukee's. They, as you said a minute ago, it doesn't happen that you get another team. It doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, I can only think of three other cities. Seattle twice. They had the Pilots and now the Mariners. Kansas City with the Athletics and now the Royals. And Washington, right. They're on their third franchise.
But it's not commonplace. Yeah. And Milwaukee, who the heck wanted to come to Milwaukee? I mean, Milwaukee's a small city, but I think that makes it more intriguing, Warren, when you see a smaller city like Milwaukee getting it again. And it's hard to say whether MLB really wanted a team here. You know, they looked at Montreal and gave them an expansion franchise. And I think that, you know, Milwaukee was a flyover city for a long time, but you got to give Selig and his crew a lot of credit for making that happen. And he's the sole reason we have baseball in Milwaukee today. So that's why I spend a lot of time on him in the book. I'm intrigued. You know, you mentioned Herb Cole. These guys grew up together as kids. They were young, you know, 10-year-olds together. And for those that don't know, Cole went on to become a U.S. senator
right.
for a long time. Then he owned the Bucks. And so they went to Madison together, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the same fraternity. It's just strange how these guys have had a lifelong friendship. But
exactly.
Another thing in my experience with this book is Henry Aaron and Bud Selig's friendship. And I was blessed to conduct probably one of the last interviews with Henry Aaron for this book. And I dedicated it to him. And when I was a kid, when he first moved up here, I used to deliver his newspaper. He lived two flights above us in a high rise.
Oh, wow.
And I used to go up. We were 709. He was 909. And I used to go up there, and I only met him once. But this is it was just an amazing experience. The year before, I had kept the headline of his home run, and then the year later, he was back with the Brewers. And I got to, I met him once. He came out to the door in shower sandals. And I actually reminded him of that some 40 years later. 50, you know what I mean? I said, he goes, oh, really? Yeah. He goes, I don't remember, but okay. And the neatest thing for me in that interview was I said, Mr. Aaron, and I was humbled by this interview, Warren. I've interviewed them all. Uh-huh. But I asked Lon Casper what... I was nervous, and I said, how should I broach an interview with Henry Aaron? He said, just ask him what it was like trotting onto that field for the first time, you know, in County Stadium. That's exactly what I did. And I asked him another question that I'll always remember. I said, what would you have done if it weren't for baseball? And he thought for a second and laughed and said, oh, no, I don't even want to think about that. And so I've got that memory with Hank Aaron, and nobody can take that away. And so, yeah, wow, a lot of stuff we covered in terms of the Brewers' history, the Braves' history, and then the concerts that were there. And Bob Hope did a gig there, and Jehovah Witnesses had huge gatherings, and the Ice Capades were there, and WWE. And so all that kind of comes into the big boiling pot of County Stadium. And in answer to your very first question, why, I mean, people have come to me since then and said, oh, my gosh, nobody has done anything on it. And I am going to say something here because I can. The Milwaukee Brewers didn't help me one iota on this thing.
Oh, boy.
They did not lift a finger. And it's my guess that they, you know, are not happy. Because this goes into my thinking on baseball. And stop me if you don't want to hear any of this. But this goes into my thinking that, you know, you got to respect your past. And the Brewers don't do that. I had a pitcher, I don't want to say his name, but a very well-known pitcher said, the Brewers didn't give a damn about me after I left. I've had other people say, bleep the Brewers, other major people that you know of, that I won't say their names, but I'm not happy that they treat their legacies that way. You know what I mean?
That's interesting.
I think it's unfortunate, this Mark Adonasio regime, and it's all a different world now. I don't have to tell you. When they sold the team in 2000 or whatever it was, we've embarked on a Disneyland kind of thing now, a Disney World, where Rick Schlesinger actually ran some form of Disney World, and he came to take over the Brewers. It's not my game anymore, Warren. I hate to say it. I've grown. Let's just say we're separated right now.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And we're trying to rekindle. I mean, I don't know if anyone else feels that way, but I miss the times of sitting in the bleachers with a friend and having a beer, and while they're warming up, talking to each other, not on my phone, not need to be blasted with music, not need all this flash from a scoreboard. I don't want any part of it, and I don't mean to sound like, I mean, like I say, I feel like I was 21 yesterday, but I'll be 60, and I only want to do things I want to do, and I would rather go to a minor league game. I'd rather go to a neighborhood game here, the Chinooks, who play down the road. They're a wooden bat league, and I don't know. I know you didn't want to talk to someone who's sour on MLB baseball. But
it's all right. It's an interesting viewpoint. Let's, for a moment, though, let's go back to the other team that played there that you talked about, the Packers.
Yeah,
first, they were there from 53 to 93, like you said, for 40 years. For those of us who are not from the area, just quickly, how far is it from Milwaukee County Stadium, or where Milwaukee County Stadium was, to Lambeau Field?
Okay, I'm right in between the two, almost, where I live now on the lake. And it takes me about 35 minutes, 40 minutes, depending on traffic, to get to Miller Park or County Stadium, what it was. So 45 plus, it's an hour 15 from here to Green Bay. Okay. Hour 15 plus 45, so 2 hours.
2 hours. All right, so let me ask you this. How hard, or was it hard, for the players on the Packers to split time between the two stadiums?
You know, I've asked a few of that. Don Horn, who played for Lombardi, I talked to for this book, and they liked coming to Milwaukee because it wasn't Green Bay. And if you've ever been to Green Bay, there's the Packers, and that's probably it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they enjoyed coming here. Don Horn said he met his wife here. It's hard, you know, if it were the other way around, you know, they played Milwaukee and then went to Poughkeepsie, you know, I could see them being a little less enthused. But at least the guys down here, you know, some of the guys got haircuts they couldn't get up there, and there was a lot of love for coming down here, believe it or not. And they actually got a lot of special treatment from the Brewers. Bud Selig did more for their locker room than he ever did for the Brewers players. They wanted the Packers down here in a big way. I think there was some talk about, you know, like I said earlier on in the conversation, that Bob Harlan told me special friendship with Bud Selig is a large reason the Packers are a success today. And he basically gave them carte blanche to do whatever they needed in Milwaukee. So in answer to your question, I think most of them that I talked to enjoyed coming to Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. And what about for the fans that used to go to County Stadium to see the Packers play? How disappointing, or was it disappointing, to see the Packers move full-time into Lambeau? And
well, you have to remember.
Yeah. Was there ever any talk about putting them in Miller Park?
Well, I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, no, I'm asking if there ever was.
Oh, God, no. If you've not been to Lambeau, that's got to be one of the premier.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean,
the world right now.
I mean, like a game.
No,
or
but
two
I do want to touch on. They were loved down here when they left. You know, it was a business decision. You know, Bob Harlan knew what he was doing. He gave them a gold package. I don't know if you're aware that he gave them four games a year up in Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he stripped them. He knew and paid respect to the Milwaukee. And I got to be honest, I don't think anybody really cares. They love Lambeau. And I mean, Milwaukee County Stadium was a lousy place to watch football, and all the teams were on the same sideline. They'd rip up that old ball field and give Bud Selig an ulcer about ripping up his field. And so it was a lousy place to watch football. So if I were a season ticket holder of four games a year, I'd rather have gone to Green Bay anyway. And like I said, from Milwaukee proper, it's just like an hour and a half compared. I was, you know what I mean? 2 hours, hour. It's not a bad drive.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so I think people were not at all. I mean, yeah, if he hadn't given them the gold package, yeah, I think there'd be a lot of animosity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like saying, well, you can watch this in a much nicer place. So it's nothing but farmland between Milwaukee and Green Bay. It's an easy drive and a spectacular stadium. So I think that, you know, if there was some disgruntled folks, it went away pretty quick.
Okay. So Milwaukee County Stadium itself, you know, like you said earlier, there was no tenant when they built the stadium. They took a chance on building the stadium without a full-time tenant. And there were so many obstacles, and you talk about this in the book. Funding falling through, problems securing land, World War II, the Korean conflict, just so many hurdles to clear. It was a very long process to get the stadium built, again, particularly without a tenant. So how did they finally secure funds to build the stadium?
Well, there were bonds. There were a multitude of efforts to kind of do this. And I think that Milwaukee folks are pretty, they like their, keep their wallet closed, for lack of a better term. And I think that it took a lot of cajoling and a lot of politicking to get these folks to say, look, you know, this is what we need. This is how we're going to do that. So they sold a lot of bonds. They had you know, communal effort in the communities. It was something that, you know, I can't imagine happening today. So it was really a coming together of folks that figured, you know, there were still a lot of people that didn't want to do it, and county board and of people like that. But I think they just figured, you know, we have to do something like this to move forward. And so, like you said, there were obstacle after obstacle, but they borrowed from Peter to pay Paul. They did whatever they could, break open piggy banks, and just to make it happen, you know. And I think the odds of that happening then were pretty slim, but they defied those.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now there is a stadium, but no team. And rumors swirled for a couple of years, but nothing concrete. And then two teams were really floundering in the cities in which they were playing. You had the Boston Braves and the St. Louis Browns. And ultimately, it was Lou Perini, who we talked about just a little bit about just a short time ago. It was Lou who moved his team, the Boston Braves, to Milwaukee. Why the Braves and not the Browns?
Well, I think it's Bill Veeck was the part of the issue. I think Bill, as we all know, was I think he was a crazy genius. I think Perini had, well, you got to remember, Perini had a relationship with Fred Miller. Mm-hmm. Fred Miller of Miller Brewing. And that was probably 90% an answer to your question. I don't think the Browns really ever had much of a chance. They certainly tried. I think that Perini's relationship with Miller was open and shut in terms of the Braves coming. And there's one thing somebody told me about Fred Miller that I also have to thank Miller Coors for being so gracious with this book. They gave me a bunch of photos, and they were very kind. And but Fred Miller died in a plane crash. And had he not perished in the plane crash, a lot of people have said the Brewers or Braves never would have left town, because he had that much of a love for this, and he was that much of a staple of the community. So I think it's the relationship there that was pretty much sealed. And if the Browns had any chance at all, it wasn't near what the relationship between Miller and Perini was established.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the stadium itself, Jim? At the time, I guess you might be able, or you could have called it a cathedral, $5 million to build. What were some of the great features about the stadium, and what made
were there great features, Warren? What are you talking about? Great features?
All right. Well, what were some of the nuances? What were some of the nuances? And
well, I don't think they became nuances until it was an old park. You know what I mean?
Well, tell us about the stadium.
It became the relic that we love. Like a friend of mine said, it was a dump, but it was our dump. You know, I mean, it's like I can call my brother a jerk, but you can't. And it was like a ballpark that, you know, I mean, it's difficult to think of anything, you know, charming. It was just, but the funny thing about that is that for us in those days, it was what went out on the field. You know what I mean? We didn't think we were sitting in old seats. We didn't think we were sitting in a dilapidated bleacher. I never went to County Stadium and said, wow, this is a horrible place to see baseball. I went to County Stadium because it was a ballpark with a major league team. And I think that, you know, I honestly mean that. I mean, never once do I remember, as long as the beer was flowing and the guys were on the field, I couldn't have cared less. And I don't remember once saying, gee, I wish I had a roof, or gee, I wish I had a big flashing scoreboard to watch, or gee, you know, play some music till I can't hear the person next to me. I mean, County Stadium, I mean, anytime they did something was like putting lipstick on a pig. And I mean that lovingly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I really mean that lovingly. They tried a suite, you know, they tried to do a suite before Miller Park was even, I mean, we haven't touched on the tornado that was getting Miller Park and how nobody was going to see that happen. We could have lost baseball again. But getting back to County Stadium, at the same time, I don't think there was one special redeeming feature about it. It was a green grass, and it was, you know, it had a wall and the guys would run into, and it was so open. I mean, such open spaces that mm-hmm. you grow up with that memory now. I fear for these kids growing up in Miller Park with their cell phones and being basically seeing baseball inside. They will never know what it was like.
Right.
So, in answer to your question, I can't think of one amenity that I was enamored with County Stadium, but I do know that I would take it 100 times quicker than I would any other new ballpark today. What does that say? I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, I go shopping at Goodwill because I like the retro stuff. Jerseys I have are all retro. I don't like any of the new stuff. And I think the analogy is not that off there, Warren. I think that we went to County Stadium to see baseball. I didn't want to be charmed by the big urinals, or, you know, I didn't care if people were spilling beer on each other or the occasional fight in the bleachers. It's become too antiseptic for me sometimes, but I think that everything I wanted was on the field, and I can't remember one single. It was Bernie Brewer's chalet when he'd slide down into a mug of beer and balloons went up, but that kind of waned when I got into high school. It didn't mean that much to me anymore, but all of it was on the field, 100%.
For so long, at least the way I look at it, Milwaukee has had a tough time with pro sports teams. You know, just now the Milwaukee Bucks and the Atlanta Hawks played each other in the Eastern Conference Finals of the NBA playoffs. I think there are many out there who would be surprised to learn that the Hawks actually were in Milwaukee at one time. They were the Milwaukee.
I didn't learn that until when I watched it on the NBA.
Yeah, they were the Milwaukee Hawks from 51 to 55. Then they moved to St. Louis before moving to Atlanta. The Braves, they were only in Milwaukee from 53 to 65. And now, of course, the Brewers have been there since 1970. And the Packers, you know, one of the originals since 1921. And the Milwaukee Bucks have been there now since 1968. Why do you think, and you sort of touched upon this earlier, Milwaukee had difficulty or didn't support their teams regularly like they do now? Why did the Hawks and Braves have to leave Milwaukee?
Well, I can't speak to the Hawks. I don't know what the climate was for basketball then. I mean, it was probably a totally different world. But as far as the Braves, I don't know. I mean, Milwaukee is a tough town to really embrace in that way. But again, we're going back to why. Basically, you're asking why you think we lost teams in the first place. Is that kind of where you're going?
Yeah, you know, and the other part to it is when a city loses a team, it's like a death. And, you know, when you look at the Braves, it was so disheartening for Milwaukee to lose this team that it supported better than any other city had supported its team. And, you know, Perini neglected the team, but I guess the neglect of Perini, yeah, if he's not going to care about the team, then I'm not going to care about the team.
Well, he already proved that by leaving Boston. I mean, you know, I don't want to knock Perini, but it sure seemed like he had always had one foot out the door. And to me, that doesn't engender loyalty. You know, I mean, the Packers, for lack of a better term, were horrible when I grew up in the 70s. I don't think they ever won. I mean, a couple of games here and there, but you still couldn't get a seat. I mean, what does that tell you? You know, I mean, these games would sell out, and in L.A., there would probably have been 10 people there. And I don't even know if I'm exaggerating. Mm. So you have to ask yourself about that kind of fan base, and they are rabid. And since 1982, I mean, why are they excited about it? I mean, I don't understand, you know. And the Bucks, you know, I won't go into too much history, but, you know, there's players I remember. I remember beginning of this conversation, you asked why, and I was always enamored with the periphery, but I'm enamored with Sidney Moncrief, Paul Pressey, you know what I mean? I'm
in, sure.
And Bob Lanier's.
The old timers.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Dr. J was a god to me. And these kids today, when I say kids, I mean, you know, LeBron's, and I mean, you know, Kobe's and all that. And I grew up with Michael Jordan, and those were just lofty things to me. I don't know. It's just the old guys to me represent what I was, and they were a lot of them were working guys and Larry Birds, and the it just seems different to me. God, I never thought I'd be this old guy complaining about sports not being as, you know, I mean, you look
I hear
back
you,
now,
man. Those, I hear you.
I mean, you see these young kids today, and you know they don't give a damn about anything except getting paid, and sure they want to win, but they go to the next city that wants to give them the guaranteed contract. But I think that goes back, you know, there's a love of baseball that, as I said once earlier in this conversation, I've lost a lot of it. I'm sorry, I, you know, I, I love baseball more than anything, but I don't know if that's the age thing or whether the money has wrecked it for me or the ambiance has wrecked it for me. You know, there's a lot of things. So, but I, again, this all points back to why I wrote this book or why I put this book together, because I'm yearning and crying and pain for that kind of experience again, because you can't take that away from us. We had a life there. We don't, I don't have that anymore. I don't share that with the players anymore. And, you know, did that happen to our fathers? Did they say, you know, we don't have the Ted Williams anymore? We don't have the, you know what I mean? I don't know. Is it a generational thing, or do we lose something in the translation? Mm-hmm. I think it's losing something in the translation. I mean, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. and all these guys, to me, I would take 10 Ken Griffey Jr.'s over one Ryan Braun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, just, I don't know what I don't know what that is. Am I an old curmudgeon? You know, give me one Johnny Bench, and you can have four Jonathan Lucroys. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's just a different game.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. Well, we lost in innocence. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
We lost when we sat around with the baseball cards, and now it's been taken over by video games. And we've lost so much of the tactile element of all that. You know, I mean, when we used to hang out and get those helmets, remember the plastic helmets for these guys and all our teams, you know, when I was had the A's, when I was 10 years old, Bert Campaneris, you know, Rally Fingers, all those guys. It just, you know, I think that when we were younger, we weren't, the analogy between cell phones and the flashing of the stadiums now, they have to. These kids will lose, they still lose interest. When was the last time you saw a kid paying attention to the game and not on his cell phone? You know, I mean, I'm sorry, that's, it's not the same thing anymore. And
that's why
I wrote the, put the book together, because I figured I owed myself that much, and I owed County Stadium that much.
Well,
you know what I mean? I owed County Stadium a chance to give it a nice eulogy, because, you know, all this other crud we have to deal with today. But I really felt, you know, I'm not saying that was my impetus, but I am saying, you know, seeing the people's response to it. I have guys buying 8 copies of these things, asking me to sign them, giving them to families. I have people from Puerto Rico asking for it. Just a weird outpouring of people saying, thank you. And I'm like, really? You know, you're thanking me? And it was just, what does that mean? I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a lot more of us than we think that do miss miss that, you know, interaction with players that they used to have and being close to them on the field. And because they were one of us then, they weren't superstar billionaires.
Yeah, it was different.
And the one thing I want to bring up is the parking area. People talk about this all the time. To get into the clubhouse, they would literally have to walk from the parking lot to the clubhouse, and people were there. They literally had to walk through people, the fans, until there was no other way around it. It wasn't like they drove underground parking, you know. Now they had to go and walk right by the fans. And I think, you know, that's the neatest thing for me is, you know, you'd have your Robin Yelts walking by these kids. And where are you going to get that today? We've lost that connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a grand old stadium for sure. And, you know.
So you say. I don't know that I agree with that.
Well, it was an old stadium. Let's put it to you. I think we can agree on that.
It was utilitarian. The same designers did Cleveland. So.
Well, it didn't want to go without a fight, if I follow the story correctly. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if I have my facts mixed up, which wouldn't be an unusual thing. I think the final game was supposed to be played in 1999, but the Brewers still needed it at least for a part time in 2000, something like that.
Well, you know about the crane accident.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what a horrible thing. A couple of guys lost their lives.
I got to tell you one thing that's really shakes me to the core. 3 people died during the building of Miller Park. And listen, 3 people died during the building construction of County Stadium.
Wow.
Isn't that a strange thing? And anyone I showed that to, it was in the paper. They were like, oh my goodness, that's a really sad linkage. But That's really weird, don't you think?
It definitely is. There's so many weird things like that, and a lot of things that we find out about. But to get Miller Park built, getting the land, again, the political support, dealing with the strike-shortened 1994 season, so many obstacles, right? You had all these obstacles for the first stadium, and I guess it's not that unusual that you have to clear hurdle after hurdle to get a stadium built, but like you said, there were a lot of similarities, and then the tragic accident during the construction. All led to significant delays that extended the life of Milwaukee County Stadium.
Yeah.
I mean, this stadium didn't want to go.
I was just going to say it didn't want to go. You know, and maybe it shouldn't have.
Well,
I mean, I wouldn't mind getting back to it. It's funny. A lot of more people feel that way than you think, Warren.
Well, your book recounted so many stories from so many players from baseball and football, and they all spoke about their favorite memories. And I asked you in the beginning of today's episode to share a story or two with us about Milwaukee County Stadium, whether it was a memory of yours or somebody else's, and I was hoping you could share one more.
You know, it's been a while. I did a lot of press on this, and I'm a little spent.
Well, anything from Bart Starr, any of the Packers, you know, is there any other?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did talk to Chris Jackie. I don't know if you remember the last game played at County Stadium was Brett Favre. Brett Favre was crazy, you know, he was a talented, crazy guy, and he would drive Mike Holmgren crazy. So he did a scramble, and they beat the Falcons on a last-second touchdown, and that's one of those things that live in folklore in Milwaukee. I think that one sports memory is indeed that one. And I talked to Chris Jackie for the book, and he didn't even realize he made the last point at County Stadium with the extra point.
Wow.
He goes, oh, my God, I did do that, didn't I? I mean, here's a guy, you know, 28 years later, I had reminded him of what he had done. He never even thought about it. And then I think that Cecil Fielder hitting a home run out of the ballpark, I talked to Dan Plesak, who has been a friend of the book, and there is a sports reporter named Jim Paschke, who now is the play-by-play for the Milwaukee Bucks and has been for a long time. So before the game, they're talking, and Plesak says to Jim Paschke, you know, I just got a divorce, you know, and I got a new dog, and I'm trying to think of a name for the dog. He says, can you help me with that? And Jim goes, you know, I'll think about it, you know, I'll do my best. So the game went on. So later that night, Plesak faced Cecil Fielder, and he delivered a fastball, and Cecil Fielder literally knocked it out of County Stadium. That had not been done. And so after the game, Plesak, understandably upset, he comes into the clubhouse and he sees Paschke and says, I know what I'm calling the dog, Bleeping Cecil. So those are things. I mean, if we sat here and went fingered through the book, you know, I'm sure there's many more that come to mind. It's just, you know, you hate to say that it's one onion and every story is peeling away a layer of that onion. And it's hard for me to, you know, I wish there were one that stood out. The Easter egg thing sticks out. John mm-hmm. Adam was incredible. I think, let's be honest, a lot of baseball players that I talk to are not exactly effusive with their language. And some of the memories are very concise and too concise. But I talked to Ben Ogilvie. Who was an amazing, I don't know if you remember.
Mm-hmm, sure. He had some
what
power.
What a neat guy, very smart guy. We talked about, you know, his swing. We talked about his approach. We talked about his quick wrists. And that's the thing for me. As a journalist, I love talking to these guys about what they did, what they felt in the morning when they put their feet on the ground, what kind of game they were going to have. You know, I mean, when you're going in, day out, and it's to me that kind of stuff that always fascinated me, you know, and some of the other guys, a lot of these were email memories, but some were conversation, like Henry Aaron, obviously. And I talked to Wendy Selig-Crebe, It was Bud's daughter, and I talked to Plesac for a couple hours. I talked to Gorman Thomas at length. I mean, when I say a couple hours, on the phone, that's a long interview. And I talked to, as I mentioned, Hank Aaron, but Bob Harlan became a good pal. We talked for about 3 or 4 hours, and his story, he worked, I'll tell you one more that'll come to mind. Harlan worked, he was a Marquette grad, editor of the paper. Then he went and worked for St. Louis and PR. Then he went up to the Packers. So, I mean, he had a really neat little 3 jobs in his career. I had 3 jobs last week. And he talked about that. And then there was another one there. I had it, but I lost it. I'm sorry, Warren.
Well, you know what? Let me say this, Jim. I would encourage anybody out there to get a copy of the book. It's really terrific. It's fun. You don't have to read it in one sitting. You pick it up. You read a couple of memories. You put
it down.
Well,
you know, it's funny you should say that, because it's not a coffee table book, but it is a coffee table book. Because, you know, it's 3 pounds. So when I mail it out to you, it's going to be a 3-pound book. And so I tell people, put it on your coffee table. So when you're waiting for someone to go out to dinner, they can look at some of these memories, while you're waiting for somebody to cut ready. And I think that's the beautiful thing about this. It's one of those things you can leave there and someone goes, oh, my God, I remember that. Or, wow, what a beautiful memory. And I should say that some of the memories I got from Del Crandall's kids, who passed away recently, and they were so grateful for the opportunity to, pay respects to their father, who was, passed away recently. But, and I had people that, I don't know, you think even the smallest memories, Warren, when people can share that, maybe it wasn't like earth shattering, but it was special to them to remember all these years later. And I think that, that's the thing that's tickled me the most, is that they remembered that after 50, 60 years, and it stayed with them. And like, they may not be monumental in terms of what happened, but they were monumental to them. And I think that's what makes the book neat.
Mm-hmm. Well, On Story Parkway, Remembering County Stadium, a lot of fun.
Yeah, if you want it, my name is Jim Crynes, just Jim, C-R-Y-N-S, @gmail.com. I'll get it back to you. I'm real good about that, and I'll send you the book. We can talk later about, send me an email and say you want it, and I'll get back to you. But I really think that some of you folks would really enjoy it. As Warren has said, it's really a labor of love. I worked 2.5 years on this project, and it's really something that I'm most proud of anything I've ever done, just because I act as a conduit for all this love for this old dilapidated shack and what it represented. If we're talking about this thing 21 years after they ripped it down, how many other stadiums do they talk about? I mean, do they? I don't know. Are there stadiums that they reminisce about this much? I'm sure. Some parks they do, but I don't know. It's some about this old hunk of junk that people still love.
That's awesome, Jim. I want to thank you so much for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes, and I hope I get to talk to you again.
My pleasure, Warren. Thank you so much.
You got it. So a few other details for you about Milwaukee County Stadium. Ground was broken to build the stadium on October 19th, 1950, and it opened on April 6th, 1953. The cost to build it was $5.9 million. Now, with inflation, they calculate that figure to be just about $57 million in today's dollars. Not a lot. The Braves played there from 1953 through 1965, and the Packers played there from 1953 through 1994 on a part-time basis. The Brewers moved in 1970 and played there until 2000. The stadium was demolished on February the 21st, 2001. One other interesting note about the stadium. Years ago, I wanted real stadium seats for my home office. I searched eBay and found a set of wooden seats from County Stadium. Pretty reasonable, too. The cost was just over $200. So I bought them, built a base for them so they could be used, clean them up, and they sit in my office. Just a cool thing to have. Anyway, I would like to thank my guest, Jim Crines, once again. And if you would like a copy of his book on Story Parkway, remember, you have to reach out to Jim on email. That's jimcrines@gmail.com. Again, jimcrines@gmail.com. jimcrines@gmail.com. Next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes, I'm going to talk about a pitcher who had a pretty good career, but when it came to pitching in the World Series, without exaggeration, he might be one of the greatest World Series pitchers of all time. And yet, his name is not one at the top of mind of any baseball fan. And I bet it's a name that very few remember. Monty Pearson. That's next time. For now, thanks for listening. And I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.